have come at a second marriage by way of both of these. For those of you who do not know my background, I was married for 35 years. My wife was diagnosed with malignant lymphoma cancer on November the 4th, 1989. She died on November the 10th, 1994. I had approximately 5 years of struggling with that disease. I understand the problems of death. In my own personal family, we've experienced what I call the three different types of death. My 28-year-old nephew was killed before his father's very eyes in a race car in 1983, left a wife and a small baby. My brother, who is the person who gets all the checkups, he's the epitome of health. He's the person who falls out of a deer stand 19 feet, walks away from it, died of a ruptured aorta on September the 27th, 1993. Claudette, of course, died after 5 years of illness. So those are the three different ways, basically, it happens. Somebody asked me one time, which way is the best? I said, not, because they all have pluses and minuses to them. So I come in the idea of recovery from death. Lynn comes from another angle.
I am Lynn Jones. This song.
There we go. I'm Lynn Jones, who can't work the PA system. I was married for 23 years to a physician. About 3 years ago, that whole thing blew apart because of infidelity. Worst storm of my life. A lot of pain, a lot of healing. God is very good. I prayed to die more than once. I wanted to die. That would have been much easier than walking through what I walked through. However, he had other plans. I met Jerry in January of last year. I had never heard him speak but one time, and I think that kind of hurt his feelings, actually. The one time I had heard him speak, my own storm was so bad, I didn't remember anything he said except one joke. After we started dating last spring, he said, "You do realize that you're dating someone who has made one segment of the Brotherhood mad at him at one time or other." Fortunately, they've not all been mad at one time. He said, "Those that don't like me, don't like me. Those that love me intently, severely, passionately. Can you deal with that?" I said, "I think I can." I said, "I tell you what, we'll just have joint custody. You give me trouble, I'll just send you someplace for the weekend." So that's the way we work.
What's interesting about that, was it this room you heard me speak?
This was the room I heard him speak in.
3 years ago, right here, she heard me speak. And obviously I didn't meet her until after Claudette's death. As a side note for that, I was invited to a dinner that her mom and dad, brothers and sisters were all there, nephews, sons. And I was there and met everybody. And her sister was there, and just as the dinner was breaking up, I noticed she didn't have rings on either hand. Sometimes when you're single, you notice things like that. But she had so impressed me, I didn't remember her name. I had to call her sister up and remember her name. But that's another story. We feel that death and divorce are the dissolvement of a marriage before death and divorce. One thing that's common denominator with it is pain. You can't get away from it. And one thing that Lynn has taught me is that you have the ability to recall pain. Watching a wife die by degree for 5 years is not any fun. A marriage dies a long time before the person dies. To some of you, that will sound cold and cruel, but some of you will understand what I'm saying. It's a very difficult thing. Common to both of our experiences is the loss of a spouse. That spouse many times could have been, or maybe has been, the focal point of that family. Claudette was a very important ingredient in my family. Because I traveled so much, she was the constant at home at all times. And all of a sudden, to my three children, the focal point was gone. The day of Claudette's funeral, I gathered the kids in the basement. And I said, "Gang, we've lost a very important member of our family. But that doesn't mean our family is going to dissolve. We are going to go on. Different? Yes. Can't go back home again? Yes." And so, as a common denominator of both our situations is there's a focal point of the family. Also involved in that, when a marriage is dissolved by death or divorce, is the loss of the presence of that person. They're just not there. You think any moment they're going to come around the corner, but they don't. You can visualize those people. I can remember after Claudette's death, something would happen. I said, "Oh, Claudette's going to be excited to learn that." Because you operate as if they're still alive. And then it brings about the loss of a mate or a partner that you've had for a period of years. I started dating Claudette when I was 19. 35 years of marriage. And it felt so strange then not to have a mate or a partner anymore. So we feel the common denominator between the two of us is the loss of a mate. Subtitle under that are three different areas that a person must deal with in the loss of a mate, either by death or divorce. And we believe this is also a common denominator. The first area that you have to deal with is the area of forgiveness. In my case, you have to wrestle with the problem of why does this person die? You have to give them sometimes the permission to die. Sometimes, in this case, a person can get mad for the person dying. You have to deal with unresolved issues. Fortunately, in my situation, Claudette and I were able to sit down, and any unresolved issue between us was definitely resolved. And a forgiveness must take place then for any of the problems or the difficulties that we've had.
As far as divorce is concerned, forgiveness is also an issue. Initially, you have to accept God's forgiveness. Forgiveness for humanness, forgiveness for failure, regardless of whose fault the marriage is no more. And then once you accept God's forgiveness, you must begin to forgive yourself and finally to forgive your spouse. Sometimes those aren't very easy things to do because there is a real game that one has a tendency to play. What if? What if I could have done this better? It's my fault. It's my fault. And even logically, if you know much of that is not true and you realize what happened and what went wrong, working in humanness, no one is perfect. Nevertheless, there is a tendency to blame self. And so that too must be, you must forgive yourself. You've got to let go of that. In addition to that, perhaps the hardest one is to forgive that spouse. Especially when there has been a wrong done to you. The human nature wants revenge. The human nature wants to get back at, to hurt as badly as you have been hurt. But God says that vengeance is His. He repays. The key to forgiveness I found in my own personal journey in this particular situation was to be able to look through the event to God that was the biggest. Because you see, if you focus on the event itself and all the hurt that was done to you, then you turn inward and you become bitter. And you become angry. Someone said the best revenge if someone does something to you like that is to have a happy life. And I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. You see, if I become bitter and old and angry and hate, then in essence I become a slave of the person that I hate. And I refuse to do that. I will not let the devil win twice. He may have destroyed the marriage, but he will not, by the grace of God, have me. That doesn't mean reconciliation. That doesn't mean that I agree with what was done. But that does mean that there is a time to go, a time to let it loose, to forgive.
Adding to what Lynn has said, I feel that the events that happen in our lives, whether our situation or mine, can either be stepping stones to something greater or stumbling blocks, depending on which one you want to make them. Neither one of us would have written our lives the way we did. There's not a person among you that would have written your life the way you have. You would have redone a lot of pages. You'd have jerked some chapters out. You would have done a lot of things. Somebody said, it's not the size of the bump, but it's the attitude of the bumpee, on whether or not we're made bitter or better by our experiences. One of the things that we had to work out between us as we thought about a second marriage was this very area right here. Especially with her more than me because of the way she was treated. The area that we worked with very early in our marriage was I wanted to know if she could ever trust a man ever again. Because of her experiences. What you think?
Well, I had to know if I would live in the shadow of a ghost. And that was nothing against Claudette. I wish I could have known her. She leaves a beautiful legacy in Jerry and the children. But nevertheless, I had to be permission to be me and to be my own person.
A second area that has to be dealt with is the loss of the dream. The dream that you had. My mom and dad experienced their 50th wedding anniversary and dad died about 3 months later. It's just the two of us boys in the family. Had you told me that neither my brother or I would celebrate 50 years, I would have told you were crazy. Because you see, dad had been sick for the last 9 years of his life. My brother got 42 years in before he died and Claudette and I got 35 years in. And so there was the loss of the dream. The dream of retirement. The dream of growing old together. Shared history that were together. And so the loss of the dream, in my case, began to take place before the person died. Because I knew it was coming. It was not if, but it was when. I remembered the first time I wheeled Claudette in a wheelchair past the cancer treatment center of DePaul Hospital. And I knew then that my wife was sick. And I knew the time was coming. And I knew all those plans that we had about what we want to do were gone. Basically gone forever.
The loss of my dream occurred after the loss of the person because of the nature of my situation. The marriage blew, and then I found out things subsequently. The loss of the dream was something that no one ever told me. I never even read it in a book. But see, you do. You mourn twice. You lose the person, but then you lose the dream. In the case of a divorce, specifically in a divorce that was so painful and so much involved, so much garbage literally involved in it, you lose the dream of trust. When you marry, you have this dream, really very similar to the quotation that Jerry started the last session with. The idea that this person will love you forever and will be there regardless and will trust, and you can trust them and will be the constant in your life. And so the loss of a dream in a divorce is a little bit different because initially you work with the loss of the trust. You also work with loss of being loved until that mate dies. The rejection that comes, in at least my particular situation, is almost intolerable. The pain is unbearable. Everybody wants to be loved and to feel that they are lovable. And it's a dream. It's a reality for all of us, really. But nevertheless, that too is part of the dream that dies.
Lynn, didn't you, we talked about one time that you felt you could make this person love you by dancing faster. You remember talking about that?
Yeah, definitely. Of course, that gets into a whole different subject in a way, a little bit different dynamic. But sometimes when the marriage is in an emotional divorce state, and at that point, truthfully, I didn't even realize it because of my own denial, my own defense mechanisms. I knew that there was something strangely wrong and that he was pulling away. And I did not know at that point there were other women involved. But I was convinced that if I danced faster, and that was my term for being perfect in every way, then I could control him. I could make him love me. I could make him want to be with me and with the boys and with the family and do the things that I wanted or I thought that we needed as a family. But it didn't happen. You cannot make other people. You don't change other people's behavior.
The third area that we feel that's a common denominator besides the area of forgiveness and the loss of the dream, common denominator is singleness. A person who goes through a divorce or through death, as in my case, has to deal with the idea of being single. It was real strange to me because I couldn't think about when I had ever been single before. I believe I was single back when I was 19. But that was a long time ago. And the idea of being single again was a weird thing to me. And I was wondering, what am I going to do? How am I going to handle it? Am I okay? Being single at 55 is different than being single at 19. It was a different world. I had resolved, though, that it was not going to be wrong to be single. Claudette and I discussed this before death, and she said, I don't have any problem with you remarrying someday. But she said, I don't believe it would be best. I said, why would you say that? She said, I don't believe you'd put the time into a relationship that it would take. I said, you think so? She said, that's right. She said, oh, there are going to be problems with, you know, opportunities to marry. She said, in fact, she was sitting on the couch when she said this. This was classic. You had to know Claudette to understand her. She said, you know, there's a bunch of little old widow ladies out there just waiting for me to die. I said, you really believe that? She said, yep, and I already know one of them. I said, you do? She said, yep, and I'm going to tell you who it is, because don't do this one. Maybe we'll talk more about the recovery, but Claudette had, I mean, a classic attitude that was just amazing. A hospice nurse came by one time, and because of her morphine she was taking, she had what we call the jerks. She'd just slap herself, drop her pencil, just go sort of uncontrolled. So the nurse asked her, she said, Claudette, how you doing with the jerks? She said, well, I've gotten used to them. She said, well, how in the world could you get used to the jerks? She said, I've been married to one for 35 years. So that was her attitude. So that's some of the things we had to deal with, but you had to know Claudette to understand that. I remember the day very explicitly she sat down on the couch and she picked up the phone. She said, dial this number. So I didn't know what I was dialing. I dialed it, and it was the Walmart pharmacy. She's a Walmart pharmacy. This is Claudette Jones. I need to phone in a prescription. I thought, what's she doing it? I take care of the prescriptions. She said, according to this bottle, it's a 60-day supply. She said, I'm a terminal cancer patient. Just send me 30 days worth of that stuff. She hung up the phone. I thought, what am I going to do now? I didn't know if to laugh or cry. I looked straight at her and I said, I bet you wouldn't buy green bananas anymore, would you? She said, no. And so, With their attitude, I was able to discuss and deal with this idea of singleness. And I thought, number one, it's not wrong. It's not wrong. Paul was single. It's not wrong. I don't have to be married to be a whole person. I can still function. I can still bring glory and honor and praise to God. It's not wrong. And so that's one of the areas that you have to deal with your singleness, which is a common problem for both of us.
Another problem that has to be dealt with in this issue of singleness, I think, is self-concept, which really can lead into self-esteem. Self-concept is how I perceive myself. Self-esteem is the value upon which I place myself, or how much esteem I hold myself in my attributes. For those of us that have been married for a long time, and even for those or were married for a long time, and maybe even those that were not married for so long of a time, it's very easy to start thinking of oneself as a couple and without singleness, the idea of who I am. As we go through our lives, we have several different sources from which we draw our identity. And certainly, as we navigate life, and perhaps the longer we are married, we tend to define ourselves in terms of roles that we play instead of who I am. And this, too, gets into a little bit of the recovery process of death and divorce. We might hit on this a little bit later. But the idea that I am a wife and I am a mother. But those roles, you see, are subject to change at any time. Unfortunately, because our lives are so busy, many times we don't ever take the time to define ourselves in any other way other than the roles that we play. And all of a sudden, I am no longer a wife. I am no longer, or he is no longer, a husband. And so at what point then do all of my different roles integrate? I call that the point of integration. I learned this the hard way. I really thought that my God was my point of integration. I believed that. But it wasn't until my identity was knocked away did I realize that in my life, at least, my real point of integration had been my husband. I was a submissive wife. I was raised to be a helpmeet, to complete him any way that I could. My life literally circled around him, and we're not going to talk about the good and the bad of that. That's another lecture for another day. But nevertheless, that was my point of integration. I thought it was my God, but it was not. Consequently, when that happened to me, I embarked upon an amazingly painful journey in this singleness, which was to define myself. Who was I? I had gone from child to girlfriend to a fiancé to wife in one fell swoop. And through those years, I had never, ever really defined myself. Hopefully now, by the grace of God, God is the point of integration of my life. But that too is one other act or one other problem that comes when we talk about singleness. There are so many areas in this particular topic, and Jerry and I were visiting, and really this is a lecture that needs to be elongated into about three, because you have things like the couple society, you have things like human sexuality that you need to deal with. You have the idea that you loved being a couple. Were you in love with the person, or were you in love with the concept of couple? And that too has to be dealt with. There's so many issues, and we just don't have the time to go into all of them. Perhaps in some later point we can in our book and so forth. But very quickly, some things that I do want to leave you with as far as working through this issue of singleness. First of all, define yourself. Heal. Take time to heal. Heal being single. I counseled many women through the years who were going through a divorce who had a man in the wings in the divorce court. because they could not stand the thought of rejection and being single. And when I would see them clinically, many times it was because I rebounded and I made this horrible mistake. In my case, it took me years, literally, to heal. I did not date. I was determined not to because I'd seen so many mistakes. And to tell you the truth, I was afraid. In Jerry's case, I think, and we've talked about this a lot, because his wife died over a period of 5 years, he mourned in increments all along. And so it was a completely different mourning process. But he, too, learned singleness just in a different way. And so initially, heal single. Know your God. Claim His power, His goodness to heal you. He is the healer, and He will. Secondly, involve yourself with other people. The longer I stay tuned into myself, self-centered, then the longer it's going to take for me to heal. I've got to give, get out of myself, and give to others. Develop hobbies, things that I like to do, indulge myself, take care of myself. If I need to diet, diet. If I need to exercise, exercise. And get help if I need help. And we will get into that issue more in a little bit, but there's nothing wrong with seeking support groups, single support groups. Just be careful where you find them. The local neighborhood bar is not a good place.
Okay. All right, we want to conclude our part here. Now, we try to look at some common denominators, but what we want to do now is to look at some specifics about the recovery from a divorce situation and recovery from a death situation. I'm going to let Lynn lead off on this and talking about some of the things that she would say straight to you today who have come about a divorce, like her situation would be, and I'll talk about recovery from one that would be a death situation.
Again, this is going to be a whirlwind session. There's so much that we both have to share in so little time. We will both be in the booth this afternoon. If any of you want to come by and visit with us personally, we'd be glad to do that. Number one, recovery from divorce. Our perception of reality must change. I indicated, I think, in the last session that we each operate in our own perception of reality based on our own experiences, our intelligences, and so forth. And my reality prior to a divorce was that of a couple. And so the first thing that has to be done is my whole reality has to change. That sounds simplistic, but actually what you are journeying from, what you thought was real, especially maybe in a situation where you were hurt very badly and you were betrayed, and what reality really was, they're eons apart. Who you thought you were and what you represented to this person is nothing like what you really were. And so it is an extremely hard journey. And so, number one, perception of reality must change.
Let me insert there.
Yeah.
Share with them about the idea that the counseling you went through from the viewpoint of what you perceived him to be and what he really was.
Or who
okay.
I was. Right. I'm not ashamed to tell you that when my world blew apart 3 years ago, right this month, as a matter of fact, I went into a clinical depression. The counselor went into a clinical depression. I went on antidepressants for 5 months simply because I was physically dying. I went to the grocery store and turned around in a circle because of the black fog. I didn't know how to cook for my two boys. I didn't know how to pick out something to wear. I had no clue what I lectured on at the university. I knew if I was to survive, it was going to take every bit of God's strength. And He was so good. He is the biggest. Look what I got out of that. But secondly, I knew that He expected me to use my mind. And there was no pride. I had been stripped of that. And I knew to seek help. I spent about 5 months in therapy with a very competent therapist. And I would advocate that. People are resilient. They heal. But the depth or the length of time it takes to heal and the depth of the scars can be in part determined by whether or not we seek help when life goes through storms. When I was in counseling, my therapist likened it to this. And I was a little embarrassed about being there at first because, after all, here I was, the college professor, the competent person that helped other people, and here I was on the floor in pain, mental pain. And he said, "Lynn, if you had been in a car wreck, would you be chiding your body because your bones were broken and bruised and it takes time to heal?" And I looked at him and I said, "Well, no." And he said, And he looked at me, I'll never forget. He said, your mind has been in a major accident. Your mind has been in a car wreck. Why are you embarrassed to think that you don't need help or that it's not going to take time for you to reestablish your reality? In other words, he was saying, get real. You know, mental pain is just like physical pain, but somehow in our society we tried ourselves. And then I did embark on that journey. And when I was finished, I found out that the person that I thought he was did not have a single common denominator with the person he was. I thought the support system I thought I was in his life did not have a single common denominator with what I really was in his life. But my mind, my perception of reality, had convinced myself. And so my world was real, even though it was not. The second thing that we've got to realize is that our relationships change. Obviously, we've got to let go of the ex-spouse. There's a tremendous tendency there to want information about this person, to go where you're going to see this person, especially if you're the jilted spouse. Don't do it. It's just like taking a wound and slicing it open. There's a tendency to ask the children questions. What's he doing? Where's he going? Who's he with? What's going on? That's horrible for the children, and we don't even have time to get into divorce and the effects of the child. That's a different lecture for a different day. But the idea, let go. There comes a time to go. Let it go. In addition to that, let go of your friends that love war stories. There's a time to cling, to help, and to want people that have been through what you've been through. And you need that. You have to have that. But there's also a time to say, okay, enough is enough. I'm not going to relive this anymore. I don't want any more war stories. Let's go. This is a new life, a new page. And so let go of the mire, of the muck. That's the only way you ever rise above it. The third thing, in this area, is that you may have to let go of common friends and in-laws that remind you of the relationship that you're saying goodbye to. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you end in a rough note and everyone's mean to everybody and I hate you because you still talk to him and look what he did to me and all that kind of stuff. No, you don't draw them into that. But there comes a point that if by seeing them, it's a knee-jerk on you and it takes you back to a time that you are getting over. And so you more or less kiss them goodbye in love. And you let them go. A time to tell relationships goodbye. Finally, you yourself must change. You are a different person. You are no longer the wife. You're no longer the spouse. Find out who you are. And I alluded to that a little bit a few minutes ago, and there's not time to go in it much more right here. But again, let me reiterate, heal with the aid of the Almighty and professional help if you need to. Do not make the mistake of substituting another person in that hole in your life. Let God fill it. Claim His power, because He will do that. I'm living proof of that. He can do that. Heal with Him. Don't become dependent upon another person to kill the pain. Find out who you are.
We began our lecture today by talking about the common nature of these two situations. When Lynn and I first started dating, when I went to her house the first time, I looked at her and I said, "Where did you do battle?" We knew what to do. She took me then back to the back bedroom, and she said, "There, on the floor of the closet, where the door was shut, and the children couldn't hear." When she came to my house, she walked in and she said, "Where did you fight?" I took her to a little bedroom that I'd occupied for 3 years. And next to that little single bed, I said, "There on my knees is where the battle was fought." Because both of us had experienced pain. Like she shared with me, she said, "You have good memories." I've had to take my wedding books and send them off to somebody else. To her credit, the first week, she said, "I want every tape, every article, every video, everything you have about Claudette. I must know who this woman was, because she impacted you for 35 years. And so that's what I did. Claudette wrote two articles that, if you've not read, I believe they were classics. On October the 3rd, 1992, she was told that she would not live another year. She wrote an article that day, the day of her birthday, called My Last Birthday. It was published in the Christian Woman magazine about March of 1993. And I would urge everybody to read that article. Another article was published after her death in the spring of 95, Christian Woman magazine again, which was an interview on death. Again, I believe it was a class act. Claudette taught us so much about dying and death. I looked at her one night and I said, "Sweetheart, who taught you how to die?" She said, "I don't know." I said, "Well, I'll tell you one thing. You've taught me how to die." In a very practical way, we discussed death. In a practical way, she made me the power of attorney. She took me through the family records and explained everything to me. I remember one day, she took me to the store. She was unable to walk, so she has one of these little carts that you get into, and she takes off, and I'm following her in a cart. She goes into the produce counter. She said, "Come here." She said, "You see this bag of lettuce?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, when you have people over, just get this bag of lettuce, and that's the seasoning that you want to get." I said, "Okay." She went on. She goes down the aisle where the cans are. She said, "Now, when you get spinach, don't you get the big can. You just need to get the little can." Finally dawned on me what she was doing. She was teaching me to shop without her. And she was so practical in everything she did. She prepared a box of stuff that she wanted for the children, put their names on it. Many times in those last days, I remember seeing her sitting in bed one time, and she said, "Chris Ann, you see that necklace? That's going to be yours." And we worked it all out. And so in a practical way, she worked some of these things out. Now, what do you do as a surviving spouse? I believe that you need to develop some close people with whom you can talk. There's some things I couldn't talk with Claudette. And I had to have some people in my life that I could be open and honest and upfront with. During the last days of her life, she died at home. I took pictures of everybody who came by. I've kept that album. I kept it for the sake of my children, unborn grandchildren, for the sake of her mother who could not be there. There are a lot of personal struggles you have as a man. I remember the last days of Claudette. I would go to church and somebody would always lead a prayer for Claudette. We'd pray that she might live. And the only problem is you have your head down and you're praying for her to die. Because she wants to die. Because when you lose the quality of life, quantity, folks, there's nothing there. And you've got to be able to talk with people and to work through those struggles. She discussed the funeral arrangements. We knew exactly what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. At the close of her funeral, the interment in the cemetery, a young man spoke by the name of David Bearden. He said a few words, and he said, "If you want to say anything about Claudette, just speak out." And people spoke out words or phrases. He said, "When a person finishes a race, we're all excited, and we applaud his great feat." He had everybody stand at that funeral and led us, not in a prayer. But applause. First time in the history of that cemetery, somebody was applauded. But you see, that's what it's about. And you can bring closure to that. John Scott, who preaches for the Saturn Road Church in Dallas, Texas, had a tape called The Six Myths of Grief. I believe he gave it at Abilene. In my opinion, it was one of the finest tapes I've ever heard on grief. I don't know how you can get a copy of it, but find it, and it's very helpful to people like myself and others. Because you have to help those that are around about you. Your recovery and how you recover and how you deal with it is a very personal matter. Don't let anybody tell you how to do it. Because you're going to deal with it differently. I know that when I started dating Lynn the latter part of January, it was a problem for some folks, and I respect that. I can understand. It was a problem for me. But I raised the question with a lot of people. Number one, if you've been praying that God might help me and recover, do you think there's a remote possibility He answers the prayer? Or do we just pray it? And then I said, secondly, until you walked in my shoes for the past 5 years, it might be best for you to keep your opinion to yourself. Because you don't understand. We are before you today as a living testimony. There is life after death. There is life after divorce. And life can go on. I don't understand about a lot of things. But I know that God is the biggest. And God will heal us. God will be with us, and this is not the time to leave Him, because you need Him more than ever before. We have our brochures up here. Register for our newsletter, whatever you want to do. Thank you for being in our class. We love you very much, and we love one another.